Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I want to start by asking you a question. Do you want us to turn the lights
on? I'm willing to confess everything, so you can turn off the light.
Okay. I think it would be very remiss of me if I didn't begin with this question for your comment. Given that in the last 24 hours, America has changed in dramatic ways. I know also that you are an astute viewer of America because of the Jewish-American relationship to Israel. And I would be very interested in your thoughts about what has happened to us and the election of President Barack Obama.
Shalom and good evening. I'm glad to be here. I followed like almost everyone else in the world. I followed with amazement and wonder even the last election campaign. And I felt even envious for you Americans for having such a leader to be as Barack Obama, a kind of a practical idealist, he seems to me, practical in the way he ran the campaign and managed it, an idealist in the ideas that he has expressed and that he believes in, and in his way to articulate himself. There are several things that comes to mind when I think of him. First, it is his ability to mobilize the people in such a deep way that maybe for the first time in decades made politics into something that is not remote from the people, not only a kind of a dictate that comes from the outside or maybe has no contact with the everyday life, but rather he made it into something that is really relevant, something that is really personal and involves people here in the United States. And I like the way in which he addressed and addresses the more positive parts of human beings, the more hopeful places or points within the people in the United States, the places of goodwill, of belief, of believing in themselves. It is so different from other leaders, both in the United States and in Israel, who usually address the more negative, the more suspicious elements, places of anxiety, of animosity, of fear. And you could see from the reactions of Americans how eager they are to be allowed to explore these more positive elements in their being. And from that you understand how we are all deprived by not having this opportunity to explore our really better parts. And I say it as an Israeli who, due to our conflict, due to the circumstances in which we live our life, we are almost doomed to narrow and to develop the more belligerent elements and the more suspicious and the more hostile, just to be more prepared for situations of war in the place where we live. And only yesterday I could really understand in a concrete way how much we are deprived of not having this option. You know, when I speak, I remember about this moment when the president of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, when he landed in Israel after years of wars and hostility. And there was such wave that I felt yesterday, a wave of us, the Israelis, of our emotions that allowed us you know, to demilitarize ourselves in front of what used to be our enemy, Anwar Sadat, the head of Egypt. And suddenly you could see then, back then, how all of us are eager to take off these uniforms and the weapon and to just benefit from normal human relationship. And this is something, part of this joy I felt yesterday. I will just add that I know that in Israel there are people who are very worried by Barack Obama. And they think that he might be too sympathetic to the Palestinians. Well, let me tell you that first, I think that by being Barack Obama, I mean by being the fruit of the mixture of two races, Barack Obama has a kind, I would call it a kind of bifocal look at reality by nature. And this is so much more fruitful and essential if you want to solve our conflict there. It is so much more adequate to the complexity of our reality, more than the more monolithic and one-dimensional look with which Mr. Bush has approached our conflict.
You know, you're a Hebrew novelist. Hebrew is your language of writing. I would love to hear you read Hebrew from a recent novel.
I will read, actually, not from a recent novel, because usually my books are very long and they are heavy to carry when I go abroad. So I took only, this is the first part of See and the Love, the part of Momik. So I will read from it. I will just say some words. You don't have to understand the language, of course, and the content. I will just want you to hear the Hebrew, and I will feel so much immediately at home when I have the Hebrew around me. It is about Momik. Momik is a 9-year-old Jerusalemite child. He is the only child of two survivors from the Shoah, and they would never talk to him about the Shoah. And he is so threatened and frightened by their silence, by their whispers, by the cry out of his father from his out of his sleep, out of his nightmares. And like a child, he always tries to understand the reality of his parents and the secrets of his parents from the fragments of information he gathers. And he keeps hearing from everyone this phrase, the Nazi beast. Achaya Hanazit. This is how Nazism was referred to when I was a child, and even today you can hear it, Achaya Hanazit. And he really believes that there was such a kind of a beast, he's only 9 years old, that there was such a beast that tortured his parents and almost all the grown-up people he knows. And the beast used to live in the country of over there, Eretz Sham. I think of that in Hebrew and in English and in Yiddish, in every language the Jews are speaking about the Shoah, they will speak about what happened over there. When non-Jews are talking about it, they prefer to speak about what had happened then. And there is a great difference between there and then, you know, because then means it's done, finished, no more. There indicates or suggests that somewhere parallel to our being here, it's still an option. And Momik, terrified by the Nazi beast, he goes to Bella, the owner of the grocery store, and he asks her, what was the Nazi beast? What is this beast? And she doesn't want to tell him because he's only 9 years old. And he put a lot of pressure on her. And in the end, she says, you know, the Nazi beast can come out of any animal, any creature, if it gets the right food and nourishment. And of course, she says it ironically, but he's so young, he takes it very, very serious. And he decides to get for himself some animals and beasts that he collects, a cat, a raven, a turtle, and he raises them in boxes in the cellar under the apartment of his parents. He raises the Nazi beast, hoping that it will emerge of one of the beasts and then he will be able to tame it and to change it so it will stop torturing his parents. וכמעט בכל בוקר הוא היה בורח מבית הספר בזמן ההפסקה הגדולה. עוקף את הרחוב של הפייס ורץ למקולת של בלה ומגיע לשם לגמרי בלי נשימה. הוא מושך אותה ביד לפינה ותכף מתחיל לשאול אותה בלחישה שכבר הייתה חצי צעקה. מה זה רכבות המוות, בלה? בשביל מה הם הרגו גם ילדים קטנים? מה מרגישים אנשים שהם חופרים לעצמם קבר? להיטלר הייתה אימא? איפה הם הורגים היום? מה זה יודה? מה זה ניסיונות בבני אדם? ובלה, שכבר ראתה בעצמה כמה זה חשוב, הייתה עונה לו על הכל ולא הסתירה כלום. ורק הפנים שלה היו עצובים ומיואשים לגמרי. מומיק בעצמו כבר היה קצת מודאג. לא ממש עצבני, רק מודאג, אבל מאוד. המצב נהיה יותר ויותר רע מיום ליום. החיה מנצחת, זה ברור. ואפילו שהוא כבר יודע עליה הכל, ואפילו שהוא כבר לא טמבל קטן בן 9 כמו שהיה פעם, שיאמין שהיא יכולה לצאת מתוך כיפוד או חתול מסכן, או אפילו עורב, בכל זאת קרה לו הברוך הזה שהוא הגיע לאיזה מקום שהחיה כן נמצאת בו. ובכלל לא ברור לו איך זה קרה, ואיך מסתם מחשבות ודמיונות יצא דבר כזה. אבל ברור לגמרי שיש חיה כזאת. הוא הרי מרגיש אותה ממש בעצמות שלו, כמו שבלה מרגישה שהולך לבוא גשם. ורק ברור שזה הוא שבטיפשותו העיר אותה מהשינה הארוכה שלה, וזה הוא שגירה אותה לצאת החוצה, כמו שיהודה כאן דרור התגרה במצרים, במיטלה, כדי לפתות אותם לראות, וככה לגלות איפה הם מתחבאים. אבל יהודה כאן דרור היו חברים שחיפו עליו מאחור, ומומיק לבד. ועכשיו הוא מוכרח להמשיך להילחם עד הסוף, כי אף אחד לא שואל אותו אם הוא רוצה או לא רוצה. והוא יודע טוב מאוד שאם הוא רק ינסה לברוח, היא תרדוף אחריו עד קצה העולם. בכל מקום יש לה מרגלים וחברים, והיא תעשה לו לאט לאט את כל מה שהיא עשתה לאחרים, אבל בצורה הרבה יותר ערמומית וסתנית. ומה יהיה הסוף? אבל זה היה מומיק לבדו, בלי עזרה של אף אחד, שהצליח לגלות את הדרך להוציא את החיה מתוך החיות במחסן. וזה היה כל כך פשוט, עד שקשה להבין איך הרעיון הזה לא עבר לו בראש קודם. כי הרי אפילו הצו הישנוני שלו נזכר פתאום שהוא צו כשהוא מריח את הקליפות של המלפפון ירוק, והעורב, כל הנוצות עומדות לו כשמומיק מביא לו את הפולקה. כמה זה פשוט להבין שכל מה שמומיק צריך לעשות עכשיו זה להראות לחיה את האוכל שהיא הכי אוהבת. זאת אומרת, את היהודי.
That was stunning. But it raises a very interesting question that I'm dying to ask you. And that is, you know, I imagine in the audience there are people who want to be writers, writers like yourself. And I would like to know how you became such a great writer. Is that a fair question to ask?
If you just drop the word great, it would be
okay.
Fair.
Okay, how did you become a writer?
I think from a very young age I wanted to write, and I was busy writing all kind of things, and I liked it. But I never thought it will be something major in my life. And one day, it's very really, really trivial thing. I lived with my then girlfriend, who later became my wife until today, and we had a very serious quarrel, and she did what she thought is appropriate, and she packed all her belongings, which then were in one little backpack, and went to her parents in Haifa, and I was left alone, and I was desperate, really desperate, and I was led to a table, and I started to write a story about an American soldier who deserted the war of Vietnam, in Vietnam, and escaped to Austria, of all places, don't ask me why. And there he's totally alone, he has nobody, and the only ones who give him some sympathy, some human warmth, is a bunch of donkeys that he adopted. And this is the story, it's called Donkeys, I don't think it's translated into English. And the moment I wrote it, I just knew, you know, it's one of these things that happen to you once or twice in your life, that You do something, and after having done it, you know that you are in your right place. You are like a piece of jigsaw puzzle that fell eventually into its real place. And I started to write, and I just felt that this is my way, not only to understand life, but also to feel like a part of life, to be integrated, if you want, into this life.
You know, one of the constant features in your novels that I've read is the storyteller. And I remember when I read, I guess, your first most successful novel, The Smile of the Lamb, you created a fantastic storyteller, Hilmi. And then, of course, in See Under Love, more storytellers. And to really bring up one of the greatest storytellers of the Jewish 20th century, Bruno Schulz. And then in the book that my students are reading, Someone to Run With, you have Theodora. And what you write there is so powerful. Can I read it to you? The passage that I thought was so amazing about storytelling. It's just absolutely amazing. So this is Theodora, who is a Russian, right?
No, Greek.
Greek Orthodox woman who is running a pilgrimage house in Jerusalem.
Yeah, for pilgrims who will never come, because she is originally from a little island in Greece, in an archipelago in Greece, and she was sent at the age of 12 to create this monastery for people who will come from this island. And after she left the island was flooded and all its population drowned. So she was left there in Jerusalem with this place that no one will ever come to. And she took a vow when she entered not to leave this place forever, all her life.
So in the story, Asaf, who is one of the main characters, finds his way to Theodora. And at one point, she asks him to tell her his story. And he thinks his story is so silly. You write, Asaf muttered that it was nothing really, just a silly story. No, no, the little woman clapped her hands. No such thing as a silly story exists. You should know that. Every story is connected somewhere in the depths to some greater meaning. Now, I would like to ask you about how you came up with this extraordinary device of the storyteller that seems, in my opinion, to be so present in your novels.
I think that telling stories organizes the world for me, makes it more understandable and more livable, a place that I can live, or more basically a place. This is a home. You know, I think maybe the only place where I really feel at home is in the story that I write when I'm writing it. Later, when I look at it retrospectively, again, I stand a little outside. But when I write it, this is my home. And, you know, maybe the best thing is that when you write a story, everything is relevant. Everything has some meaning. And things intertwine, and things, they radiate their significance to each other. I know it because when I'm not writing, when I'm in between books, and sometimes it happens to me, unfortunately, I don't like these periods. I'm bored. I don't sleep well. I don't enjoy it. But then I know the things come one next to the other. It's so different in the time of writing. I feel I'm like a hunter, because every second can come a clue, an idea, an insight that will explain to me something. I just have to be prepared. I just have to be all the time on the alert. I sleep with pens all over the bed and near the bed because there is a good idea. So I wake up in the middle of the night and I write on the palm of my hand. Then in the morning I look at it and there is half word written and I hate myself for not being more, you know, decisive and writing. Can I tell you how Someone to Run With started?
Sure.
Because I think this illustrates the this state of mind. I was then, after finishing a book called Be My Knife, Shetilia Sakin, which is an epistolar novel, a love story between a man and a woman, written only in letters, most of it only in letters. And it was a book about a character, the main male character, Yair, is a very difficult, almost distorted person. He's someone that before he opens a door, he builds seven fences around him. And he wants to love, and he wants to be loved, but he doesn't know how to do it. Full of inner obstacles, and he finds this woman, Miriam, and he writes to her a letter. He sees her for the first time in a reunion party at school, and he never knew her before, and he saw her hugging herself, embracing herself, and she has a kind of an inner broken smile, and he immediately falls in love with her. He doesn't realize it. He feels that he has the urge to tell her his story. And sometimes I think that maybe this is what love is all about, that there will be someone to whom we shall be able to really tell our story in whole, all the parts of our story. It doesn't work all the time, but this is the basic passion and urge, that there will be somebody who will contain our story fully, totally. And he starts writing letters to her, and they are very intrusive and extreme letters, like suicidal letters, as if he tells her, you know, I'm jumping from the roof. If you do not catch me, I'll crash on the asphalt there. And she stretches out her arms and she catches him. And they start to correspond, and gradually she manages to change him and to soften him and to carve him so he will be again directed towards his real self that has been distorted by his parents, by circumstances of life. She reminds him what he should be, what he could be. I ended this book after 4 years and I was devastated. You know, this book really ruined my life in many ways, and rightly so. I mean, this is what I expect my books to do to me. Yes, I have very high expectations of my book. They should be self-destructive books. Books should be subversive against the writer, against all the relationship of a writer with his wife, with his spouse, with his parents, with his children, with his country, with the language of his country, with the taboos of his society. It should be subversive. Okay, this is in parentheses. I finished Be My Knife. I desperately wanted to write a good, fluent love story. A love story that the obstacles for the love of the two will come only from the outside, not from within the characters. And, well, I had the passion and I had, it obsessed me, but I just didn't have an idea. Small problem, but very essential one. And then one day I was about to leave my home to meet with a friend. I live in Mevaseret Zion. It's in the outskirts of Jerusalem. I was about to enter my car, and suddenly I saw this man, about 50, 55. It was winter. He had a heavy coat, and he was leading a big dog on a leash. And he saw me, and he said, "Excuse me, sir, do you know this dog?" Immediately, you know, because of this unusual approach, my inner ear started to tremble, you know. I said, "No, why do you ask?" He said, "Please give a second look. I'm chasing this dog since 8 in the morning." And that was something like noon. I said, "You know, I think most of the dogs in my street, on my street, I don't know this one. Why do you do it? Why do you chase a dog?" And he said, well, this is a stray dog. And I found it. And I believe that if I take it to his, if I follow it, it will take it me to his owner. Now, I was really struck by this act of greatness and generosity in the middle of Mevaseret. It's not something very common in our little place. And I said, chapeau that you are doing it. And he said, chapeau, shmapo, I work in the sanitation department here. This is how we find lost dogs. And believe me, he said, when I find the owner, he will have to pay me a fee for wasting my time. And he showed me there is a special form number 76 that now, and I sat in my car and I was, you know, flooded in me. I felt like, you know, honey is pouring on me from heaven, because what a story. If the one behind the dog, the, on the side of the tail of the dog, will be a young man, so the owner will be a young woman, and the dog will take this young man to the owner. But of course, the dog cannot go directly to the owner, because in that case, I won't have a book. It will be a very short book. The dog should have its own agenda. So the dog will take the young man, Asaf, to different stations in Jerusalem. And in each station, this boy will learn something new about the owner of the dog, Tamar, and gradually, through this journey, she will initiate him to become the lover of Tamar. The dog really has to prepare him, to cultivate him, so this clumsy Jerusalemite child who never really loved the woman, that he will be prepared to loving this very special and very complicated, much more complicated than himself, young girl. So This is how this book starts. It's very rare that a writer knows exactly the exact point in which a book starts. Usually it comes after I can write for a year and until I really know what I'm writing about. It's like, you know, taking layer after layer of cataract from myself, my eyes, or my soul, until I really see clearly what is the topic I'm writing about.
You know, this morning, my students were helping me prepare questions for you. And I remember that one of the students said about the characters of Asaf and Tamar, whether they might be allegorical characters. How would you respond to that student's question?
I must tell you frankly, I'm less interested in allegories. I'm more interested in the story itself. I hope that if a story is rich enough, it can contain layer of allegory, as it contains a layer of, you know, politics, of psychology, of history, of whatever. But the main thing for me is the story itself, is the line of the story, is to create this thing that, you know, the life, the inner life of the reader are reorganizing themselves according to this line when the reader reads the story. This is the thing that really interests me. I'm, again, less interested in metaphorical novels, even though I know that my book are being interpreted in such way.
You know, the student's question really then raised another question, which is perhaps even more significant, and that is the characters you draw in your novels are so wonderful. You almost fall in love with them. And
thank you.
By the time
have you been all my life?
What?
Where have you been all my life?
Here in Santa Barbara. But, you know, you don't want the story to end. The characters are so convincing. They're so wonderful. They're so wild. They're so crazy. They really reflect a kind of wonderful world, an enchanted world that you create in your novels. Could you comment about how you get these characters going?
This is one of the most rewarding parts of being a writer. You know, the ability to become other human beings. Even though they are imaginary, but they are never really imaginary. First, they are so real to myself and so much concrete part of my life, even when they are imaginary. And second, they are consist of different real people, most of them, and of myself, of course, among them. But the main thing is the ability to know the other from within through the character of the other. Let me try to explain it. It's a little story. After I finished See Under Love, Ayin Erech Ahava, back in 86 it was, I was on a bus from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and it was 7:30 in the evening. It was dark already, and there was the news magazine of the evening, and in the end, the very end of the news magazine, they had the culture corner. You know, the culture should be cornered so it will not overflow and flood us. So the culture should know its limitations. And they put it in the last minute, and there was this actor, Ili Golitsky, who read excerpts from my book, which made me very proud. And he read about Gisela, the mother of Momik. And she was working on her sewing machine. And her foot rested on a wooden pedal that was attached to the original pedal of the Singer sewing machine. And at this very crucial point, the driver, who was only a human being, Nebe, how much can he take? He switched to another station, something more cheerful of Israeli music. And I was left there with both the insult for my story and with the feeling of confusion, why on earth did I put the additional wooden pedal? Because you know, when you write a book, you do not just throw requisites and objects and items into the book. There must be some reason. I got home and I took the book from the shelf and I looked and I saw that Gisela, the mother, was so short that her feet would not reach the original pedal. So Uncle Shimek, who has good hands, and he also knows how to cheat on income tax, he fixed her this additional pedal. And then when I read it, I suddenly understood what literature is all about. Because, you know, in my own house, if there is something to fix, you know, electricity or to fix a shutter that is broken or something in the plumbing, I'm David the Plumber, you see. It will take me weeks, if not months, until I remember to do it and I find the time, and my wife complains and my children complains, and in the end I do it. But if you have in your story someone like Gisela, you become Gisela, and voluntarily this additional pedal would emerge from you, because when you are Gisela, you know that her feet will not reach this pedal, and you have to supply her, to provide her with this additional pedal, so she will be able to move the wheel of the Singer, and the whole wheel of the story will move. And you know, I'm sure that if I myself, or if any of my readers would read this book, this story, they would not have felt that something is missing there, but something was missing there, yes, and there was this little void, and maybe in another place in the story there will be another void and another one. And it will create the feeling in the heart of the reader, there will be the feeling that this writer did not really kill himself on the story, did not surrender totally to the story. And there is such pleasure in this total surrendering, in allowing Gisela to invade me and to prevail within me. And really, there is sweetness in it, because we are so much protected from others. Even here in Santa Barbara, where everyone is so nice and sympathetic and sociable, and yet I think every one of us has this little instinct of protecting himself or herself from all the chaos that radiates, that prevails inside other human beings. It can be the most significant other human being to you. Sometimes I look at couples who are married together for 30, 40 years, and they are wonderful as a couple, and they love each other, and they are affectionate, and they are wonderful parents. And yet, if you look deep into them, you see how over the years they have congealed, and they do not really evocate everything that makes this other an other. How many parts and dimensions remain mute, overlooked, ignored, feared, and eventually both parties are congealed in what in the limited point of view that their significant other sees within themselves. There is this paragraph in Waiting for Godot in the play of these two metaphysical clowns, Vladimir and Estragon. One says, "I had a dream. Don't tell me," says the other. Immediately he rejects him. "To whom shall I tell my private nightmares? Keep them private. I don't want to know." And you know, sometimes we believe that when we make love during the love making, we really know the other. Yes, in Hebrew we even say to know, ladat, ve'adam yada et chava ishto, and Adam knew his wife Eve. But of course, in such moments, we are much more tuned to the more sweet, beautiful, attractive elements of our partner, not to the parts in which he is distorted or tormented or ugly. We don't want to think about them while making love. We suspend them from our knowledge. But when we write, when I write, I want to know these other parts. I want to be exposed to the places in which the other is tormented and miserable, and I want to understand what does it mean to be you. What is the filament that goes inside another human being? And for me, and excuse me for this long answer, but there is no short way to answer. For me, this is what writing is all about: to try to look at reality from points of view of others. Let it be others that I will never be, all the others, a Palestinian storyteller, a Nazi commander of extermination camp, a child of 3 years old, a dog, whatever. But just to be able to change point of view and to explore reality from this angle.
In your most recent book that's been translated into English, which is titled Writing in the Dark. It's such a powerful, I think, title. It's made up of six essays or six presentations that you've made. And the first of these is so arresting. The title of it is Books That Have Read Me. You know, what... I've read the essay, but I want to whet your appetites a little bit. What do you mean by that? The books that have read you?
Books are reading us. It's a mutual effect. Certain books leave us indifferent, and they are not significant for us, and we probably, either we don't finish them or we forget them the moment we close the pages. And there are books that are really creating us and changing us and formulating within us things that otherwise would have remained non-existent or not, we won't be aware of them. And I tried in this essay to tell about several writers or books. One of them is Shalom Aleichem, the Jewish writer whom I discovered when I was 8 years old, and he really changed my life. I can say he changed my life. I think that because of him I became a writer. Because of him I discovered the life of the Jews in the diaspora before the Shoah. I became haunted with the Shoah. I became obsessed with the reality of the Jews in those shtetlach. I created for myself in Israel of the 60s, Israel the strong, the nation that just started to build itself up from the ashes of the Shoah, I created this Jewish enclave of the diaspora. And of course, Bruno Schulz, the Jewish-Polish writer who was murdered during the Shoah, which was so important for me. Because of him, I wrote See on the Lab.
Yeah, there are other powerful, powerful essays in this volume on writing. And I'd like to, your comment a bit on the role of imagination in writing, in your essay, from which you've taken the title, you write, "I imagine, and the act of imagination revives me. I am not fossilized or paralyzed in the face of predators. I invent characters." Now, some of that you've addressed in my questions, but it's the act of imagination, the act of creation, really, I think. I remember when I was a teenager, I read Arthur Koestler's book on creativity, where it comes from. And I've always been interested in the act of creation and creativity. And that then leads me to this question of the role of imagination.
It's a way to fight or to protest against the concreteness of life, against the burden of the concrete, what Bruno Schulz described as the walls that are besieging us. I see so many examples for it in everyday life, and of course in life in Israel, in life in what I will describe carefully as a disaster zone because of all the wars and all the effects of wars upon us and upon our neighbors. How it is easy to believe that there is no way out. Again, it applies both to political situation and to marital life, or to problematic connection with between parents and children. You see how easily people are trapped in a situation, how they regard it as a kind of divine decree, how they cannot envision that there can be another option, another way out. And I think that so many times, whenever I wrote in one of my books about an individual that faces an arbitrariness, an outer arbitrariness, and almost in all my books I deal with that, by the very act of writing about this arbitrariness, I have changed my situation within it. By the ability to imagine other options to cope with this arbitrariness, let it be the arbitrariness of the Nazis, the arbitrariness that the body has upon ourselves. For example, in the book of Intimate Grammar, where there is these youngsters who suddenly understand that the process of maturity, of becoming an adult, changing from a child to adult, it's a normal, natural process, but it's also something that is imposed on us. This is it's imposed by the bureaucracy of the glands. Yes, we do not choose it. When we are 12 or 13, we enter this tunnel of adolescence and we emerge from it when we are 17, 18. Today it's 27, 28. It has been prolonged. And we come out, we have a new body, a new mind, new urges and desires and passions that act upon us. And it's good and it's normal and it's okay. But maybe for a very sensitive person, someone with the soul of an artist, like my Aaron, the protagonist of the book of Intimate Grammar, maybe it is also a threat. It's a deprivation of his own will, of his own choice. And how do you maintain your own individuality in a process that takes over everyone and makes everyone look alike? For him, by the way, the way to maintain his individuality is to create a special language of his own. He becomes more and more aware of the role of the language in creating the uniqueness of the human being, and he realizes that he can no longer speak the language that everyone else speaks around him. So he creates for himself another brain under his heart. And in this brain, he creates a hospital for sick words. And he absorbs words from the outside, from the conversations of his parents, from the radio, from his classmates. And he takes those words that were said offhandedly, indifferently, and he purifies them with very complicated ceremonies. And only when they are purified, he feels he is entitled to utter them, that only now they are his words. And I always think that a writer is someone who feels claustrophobic in other people's words. And he feels that people that used other words in a way abused them. So he must create his own vocabulary, or at least juxtapose words in a different way, or use other metaphors. I think this is what makes one a writer. And so as I said, every book is about this clash between an individual and a kind of arbitrariness. And I found out that when I wrote about this arbitrariness, I stopped immediately to be this passive object of this passive subject of this arbitrariness, that suddenly, by the very writing of it, I discovered new nuances in this arbitrariness, or new ways for me to move more freely in front of what had paralyzed me before I started to write. And for a second, I was no longer a victim. No longer a victim. And you can understand that for me, as a Jew, as an Israeli, as me with my life experience, especially in the last 2 years, not to be a victim of something, of some reality, is a very comforting and even liberating thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, I read those lines where you, in the essay, speak about the issue of the arbitrariness of events. And I must say that I thought of Job, perhaps one of the dynamics in your work that is so compelling is that it's a retelling of the Job story to a degree, in completely modern language, with completely modern characters, with a degree of secularity, and expressed in an extraordinarily beautiful language.
I don't know even what to say about that. You know, Job, despite everything that happened to him, continued to believe in God. I am, let's say, the only sacred thing in my life is the value of human's life. And I even need to know, and I hope I do not offend anyone here, I need to know that there is no good. I need to know that the only significance of this life is the significance that we give to it. I need to know that we stand naked in front of the harshness and the meaninglessness of this existence, and it is our duty to make it meaningful. This is why I write. It's a way to make life meaningful. It's a way to make other people meaningful to me. And it's also a way to find taste in life, in the very simple, primal way, to find taste in life.
I want to turn now to your writing on politics. And it strikes me that without writers like you, we would fall constantly prey to the language of politics. And my question is, why is it that writers are so extraordinary in being able to see through the images, the propaganda, the shortness of reality, to see something else, to impose, if you will, the meaning that you just spoke of.
Maybe because writers, almost by definition, don't want to be part of the deal, the unkosher deal that is stricken, you say, mm-hmm. between the politicians and the people that they lead. In times of stress, of war, of any kind of distortion, and in a place that, as I said, I will call it a disaster zone or catastrophe zone, the first thing that is being manipulated and forged is the language. The language in which the government describes the situation and the army describes it and even the papers. And you can see how gradually there is a new whitewashed language that tries not to describe reality, but rather to obscure reality, to buffer between the harsh reality and the citizens of this reality. And it works. It works because the people want to be misled. They don't want to be exposed to everything that is being done in their name, because most of us are normal people, normal and moral people. And it's very hard to understand that we are really partners of some atrocities, and that we are really financing and supporting a government and an army that does all kind of things that we do not regard as part of our self, of our self-image, of our heritage, of our values. The problem is that, A, we are not in contact with reality when we surrender to such distorted way of not approaching things. The second is that there is a growing gap, void, between the individual and the reality. And this void never remains empty, because all the time there are elements who are acting and active within this void, and they are manipulating the situation for their interests. I think writers have also, as I mentioned before, the ability to see every situation from some points of view. And I know, for example, that there is nothing like, you know, one absolute justice. It's not the Israeli and nor the Palestinian. And there is not one way to describe the situation, and not one suffering, and not one justice, and not one tragedy. The truth is consists of so many dimensions and elements and memories and emotions. So much of politics is emotions. And I don't want to entrench or to congeal within mine, the Israeli, only legitimate narrative, because I know the tendency and the temptation of a nation to create for itself one legitimate narrative that would explain the whole situation. And as I said before, it obscures us from really understanding the situation. I think it's so important to allow the other story, even the story of the enemy, to infiltrate inside our own narrative. And we must be able to look directly at the story that the Palestinians are telling themselves. I do not say that we have to justify it or to agree with all of it. Not at all. Because the Palestinians, they have their own mistakes and their own blind spots and their own self-destruction, exactly as we do. But we have to be aware of all these this complexity of the way to describe the situation. And the last thing is that maybe writers have this urge to always look for an alternative, to find another way to get out of this problem. You know, when you write, One of the first things you become aware of is that how many options there are always. Because whenever you want to lead your character in a certain way, he or she, they say, no, let's take another way. And there are always so many, such, you know, a huge fan of options opened in every human activity. There is never a status quo. This is maybe the major mistake of leaders, that there is a status quo. But wherever people are involved, there is never status quo. And we shall always be surprised by an explosion of energy, of rage, of frustration, when we believe that something is frozen and it will remain so forever. Nothing remains forever. And we never should be victims of this thought and of our fears that prevent us from really changing the situation from the roots of it.
You've spoken about the role of the writer in a political sphere in terms of stepping into different perspectives, other perspectives that people haven't necessarily considered. And you've also spoken about the importance of imagination in the life of the writer. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on the combination of these ideas and the role of the writer possibly in offering in a political or cultural sphere through their imagination possibilities for life that a political entity or a culture have not imagined, speaking peace into war and reconciliation into grief.
I remember that some years ago I wrote an article that I called it Imagining Peace. And I tried in a very concrete, detailed way to portray everyday life in conditions of peace between us and the Palestinians, us and the Arab countries around us. And I did it deliberately, you know, to really to uproot myself, like the Baron of Minkhausen, who uprooted himself from the quicksand by his hair, pulling his own hair. I did it just to remind ourselves that there is such an alternative. Because I believe that if we do not have the ability to imagine, then we are really doomed to our fears. And then you cannot imagine the strength and even the temptation of this self-destruction, of the despair, of the apathy. And I can see how it acts upon us and upon the Palestinians, and how even the very thought of a change seems naive or even criminal, that you allow yourself to believe in something better to happen. And, well, I think I shouldn't say more. We spoke about it the whole evening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.